Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Scummy Mummies podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. I'm Ellie Gibson.
And I'm Helen Thorne.
And who have we got today, Helen Thorne?
We've got Elle from Feathering the Empty Nest.
All right, Elle, how's it going?
I'm all right. How are you guys?
We're very well, thank you. Now, Elle, why don't you introduce yourself?
So my name is Elle Wright. I am a blogger. I have an Instagram account called Feathering the Empty Nest, as previously mentioned. Thank you for the shameless plug. I write primarily about interiors and lifestyle and everything I've got going on in my life, but also I do write about loss, pregnancy loss and infant loss after the loss of our son Teddy in 2016, which has subsequently led to me writing a book on that subject as well. Quite surprisingly, that was never a plan, but that's how it's worked out. So.
Often books aren't planned like that as well. We didn't ever plan to write a book, and someone mentioned this on the radio once, and then a book agent got in touch and said, do you want to write a book about that? We're like, oh, yes, we do. Yeah.
See, did you say yes straight away? Because I kind of went, I don't know.
What was holding you back?
I thought, I'd better ask my mum if this is a good idea.
God, no,
I didn't. Literally got on the phone to Carol and I was like, this is really weird. I do, because I guess I just, when I started writing, I did it more for I guess a form of healing for myself. It was really cathartic, and I'd spent so much time completing all the dark corners of the internet, not being able to find anybody who was writing about that subject who was talking to me, because I kind of make everything into a joke. I always had done. And I know that's,
you guys, I can't imagine what that's like.
I know you both handle
speaking a foreign language.
And I think whatever it is you're communicating, whether it's everyday stuff like about being a mum and, you know, kids, and I know you turn that into humour, and it's very, very difficult when something awful and unthinkable happens to be able to make kind of jokes in that moment. But even when we were in hospital with Teddy, I was there making inappropriate jokes. I think that's just what I do. I'm the kind of person who laughs at a funeral, like, who can't like control that, and I just couldn't find anybody who was talking to me. And so I didn't expect that reaction. I didn't expect somebody to say, oh, do you think we should turn this into a book? Because actually I think that's how a lot of people deal with stuff when you know, the chips are down and it's really bad, and they just want that normal. They want to feel like normal about it.
And they want the release. They want the tension to go. Like, you know, and you want to. I was listening to a podcast the other day with Nigella, and she said she laughs at every funeral. And she said, I've been to a lot, but I can't help it. I just have to laugh in those sort of dark times. I think that's a really natural reaction. We're told. And I think, and we'll get further into it when we talk about your book, is that there are certain emotions that you have to feel in certain situations. We're told you feel sad at a funeral, you feel this at, you know, the loss of, a relative or whatever. And it's not like that. It's like grief and all those sort of things are really complicated, and you can feel all sorts of things. You feel angry and and then laugh at the ridiculousness of why is this happening.
So I saw it illustrated actually quite recently. Somebody had done an illustration on Instagram, and it was kind of the graph of grief. So first shock and then this and then that, and somebody had just done a big cross through it and gone, you know, done a big squiggle all the way through to actually it doesn't look like that. Nothing looks like that, because we're all individuals and we're all people, and we're going to feel different things at different times. And that's fine. Like, you don't have to go, oh, I'm not feeling
shocked, you're not grieving properly
today. I'm not going through the process. But yeah, everybody handles it so differently, I guess.
So I know you've told this story a lot before, but could you tell us Teddy's story? for anyone who hasn't read the
book. So, if they haven't. No. So Teddy was born in May 2016. I was really lucky. I had a healthy pregnancy. We'd got married in 2014, started trying for a baby about 6 months later, and then after 10 months, which felt like quite a long time, but you know, now I now know in the grand scheme is nothing, we found out we were expecting a baby to be born in May 2016. Teddy came along after I was induced because my waters had broken, they were leaking. I mean, I always thought it was going to be like this big, oh, my waters are broken, like a Hollywood
movie. Like Niagara Falls, yeah. It's just coming out of your front
mine
bottom.
Mine were leaking.
Like, right, just shrivelly.
Yeah. I literally stood up one morning and I was like, oh, either I've completely lost control,
yeah,
or, yeah, or I don't know. So again, I phoned my mum, and luckily she always answers in these kind of situations. She was like, you should probably go to the hospital. Went along and they were like, yeah, risk of infection will induce you. So I was induced and it was fairly like I was lucky. I didn't, but yeah, he was born after sort of 6.5 hours of active labour. He was fine when he was born. He came out not breathing, but that's quite normal. You see that a lot on One Born Every Minute, don't you? And they run away with the baby and then they come back with the baby and they're like, oh, it's fine. So I guess I was worried in that moment, but we'd been in the last stages of labour, excuse me, with him kind of on his way out the door, as it were, for a good hour and a half, 2 hours, and I hadn't been able to kind of get him out. And I think I just thought, oh, he's, you know, been in a bit of a state because of that. So they ran away with him. My husband sort of swiftly followed after they'd cut the cord. And then they came back with him about 15 minutes later. But obviously I'd been on the old gas and air, so I was having a great time and didn't really know what was going on. So that 20 minutes probably felt like about two before the paediatrician had come back in with him and was like, he's fine. He just needed a bit of a rub down with a towel. And yeah, he's like any normal baby. It takes them a few minutes to get going. So we were just treated as normal and left. Not left, that's a bit harsh. But, you know, they came in and checked on us and made sure I was okay and that I was, you know, I had a shower and got dressed. And it was like totally normal. And then we went down to a ward because it was early evening. It was like late evening by this point, a few hours after I'd had him. And my husband decided to stay over. I mean, thank God he did, because I think if I'd been on my own, don't know what the hell I would have done. And in the night, first of all, the nurse, midwife, woke me up and said, oh, the baby's a little bit cold. You need to give him a cuddle. So I was like, well, I don't really know anything about babies. Okay, that's fine. You know, I don't think any of us know. Like when we first have a baby, we're like, what is this?
And you do what you're told, right?
So I gave him a cuddle and then they were like, right, that's that. And then she came back. She was like, yeah, that's fine. Put him back down to sleep. That was about sort of 12:30 in the night. And then I guess it was about an hour or so later, she came to wake me up and she was shaking my shoulder, like, literally lifting me off the bed, shaking my shoulder. And she said, all I remember, she said, I'm going to have to take the baby, he's really cold. And as she lifted him up, his arms just flopped down by his side. And I just remember sitting bolt upright in bed and bashing Nico, to my husband, to wake up, and just sitting there like, fuck, this is really bad. And I've written about it in the book, as you guys know. It's like, I just remember seeing people running past down corridors. Somebody obviously pressed an alarm. There were flashing lights and they pulled the curtains round us. And that's when I thought, this is really bad.
Yeah.
But still in that moment, I think I was still so out of it, so tired because I'd been induced and I didn't really know what was going on. You don't after you've had a baby, I don't think, because your hormones are just all over the place. And we sat there for what felt like a lifetime. I think it was about 40 minutes before they took us into a room. And that's when I thought, this is really bad. I've watched enough Casualty to know that, you know, when you get taken into a room on your own. And they sat us down. And I just remember the doctor, the paediatrician, sort of crouched down in front of us. He was at eye level with us. And there was a box of tissues on the table. And I was 100% convinced they were going to say, the baby's died. I won't call him the baby because we haven't actually named him at that point. We kind of made that decision overnight. And they didn't. He just said, oh, you've got a really, really poorly little boy. He was resuscitated for 18 minutes before we managed to bring him back. But we don't know how long he wasn't breathing before we found him. So, of course, in my head, I was thinking, oh, he's alive. He's alive. Amazing. This is like somebody's looking down on me. And still not really realising at all the magnitude of the situation I was in. Because I don't think your brain allows you to go there. It's like when somebody you know is really ill and you know they're going to die. And you think in your head you've accepted it. But then when it happens, it's like a complete shock.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking, oh, that's going to be fine. Then we're going to be fine.
Yeah.
And then the next day we were transferred to a neighbouring hospital who had a specialist neonatal intensive care unit, and NICU it's called, and he stayed in hospital, the same hospital as us, while they stabilised him. And then the next morning we went to the neonatal unit, and we were there for 3 days before the paediatricians and all the specialists who were looking after him just said to us that there was literally nothing that they could do. So they switched his... They switched his life support off, but it was just one of those things where even then, I think your instinct as a mother like takes over. And I can remember thinking when they said that was what was going to happen, I was just thinking, shit, I can't let him just like die in a hospital room with loads of other babies and loads of other families. And I said to them, right, okay, this is what I need us to do. It was like this weird, I kind of went into autopilot. I think you just think, right, I've got one shot at this to not fuck it up and just like do the best thing that I can do.
Yeah.
So I, sorry, I've made everyone cry. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, that's all right.
Well, you've made Illy cry, which is amazing.
I'm just allergic to those flowers over there.
And I said, right, you know, this is what we need to do. So we got the doctors to... They were really good, actually. I can't tell you how good they were. And they just, like, hand and footprints with him and all of those things that... Because you're kind of trying to pack a whole lifetime of memories into what I think was, like, 2 hours, 3 hours. And then they let us take him into another room that had been a room that we'd been staying in that was, like, a family room. And they brought him in there because he'd been... For 3 days, he'd been on... Every machine going, it was wired up to absolutely everything. Because, you know, a tiny baby, so looks so tiny, and all this big equipment around him. And I was like, no, it doesn't feel right. It feels really clinical and really weird, which obviously it is in a hospital. So the midwives and nurses, they brought him through in just one of those little tanks, and they were actually hand pumping oxygen into him. And then they handed him to us and stopped pumping the oxygen, and then they let him they let us read him a story. And so that was how we decided to do it. But I just thought, there's literally nothing else I could do. I've got to do something and make it as nice a memory, because I guess my fear was that was going to be the... I think I was very aware in that moment that that was going to be the memory that we had for the rest of our lives, and I didn't want to mess it up for him and for us.
It was so, like, strong of you, because I think you feel so vulnerable and, like, everyone else is making a decision.
Yeah.
And that's so amazing that you got to own that and control that and have that as well.
I don't think there is a right thing to do. And that's the thing, is in your head, when the chips are really down, you're thinking, okay, what's the best thing to do here? What should I be doing? And I think that's a maternal instinct as well, that as a mother... You know, nobody really knows what they're doing, do they?
And something
happens, and you think, "Oh God, I'm the mum in this situation. Yeah. I'm supposed to know what to do. I'm supposed to make this right. I'm supposed to fix it and make it better." And I think because it was a situation so unthinkable and so shocking, and like nothing I'd ever expected to happen when I had a baby, I thought that because it was so out of control, that I needed to take back some of that control and be like, "No, this is how it's going to be." And so that was what happened with Teddy. And then that night we went home from the hospital without our son, and kind of realized as we were driving home, shit, this is our new reality. Like, how the hell are we going to tell people that this is what has just happened? Because when somebody has a baby, and as you both know, you know, you're expecting, and everyone's like, when's the baby coming? And it's this happy, happy, happy. And everyone's in anticipation of that really happy news. And that what should be the happiest news is completely flipped on its head and becomes the unthinkable. And then you, as the parents or as our immediate family, then have to be the ones to communicate that to everybody.
Mm.
And it is not a fun place to be. Mm. It's a shit. Yeah. It's a shit storm.
Yeah.
I didn't. It just looked like an abyss to me. Of I didn't know how we were going to get through. But then the next thought in your head is, how the hell are we going to tell everybody?
How did you tell everybody?
I kind of chickened out. I texted my best friend and I was like, I can't. I told her, mm-hmm. and I just said to her, look, Zoe, I need you to tell, think of everybody. Think of everybody we know who might want to know, and just please go and tell them for me.
Mm.
And she was an absolute gem, and she went and did it for me. And yeah, and I would do the same for her if I had to.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we were really lucky. Our friends were just all amazing, and I incredibly grateful. You know, when we really needed our families, not only were our parents there, but we're both close to our siblings as well. Nico's sister actually wrote a really nice passage in my book about Teddy and her experience of, you know, being in the hospital with us, and her experience of, you know, losing her nephew but wanting to protect her little brother, and then the following month finding out that she was pregnant again and having to tell her, like, all these different emotions that, you know, when a child dies or when anyone dies, everybody just thinks about the people, the immediate people that that's happened to. So everyone, particularly I think when you lose a baby, everyone rallies around the mother, because that's the natural instinct, isn't it?
Yeah.
Think, well, you're the one that's just had the baby, so we need to make sure you're okay. But the ripples go out so much further than just the immediate people that that's happened to, because, you know, my parents and my husband's parents had lost their grandson, our brothers and sisters had lost a nephew, our friends, you know, were in complete shock and obviously cared about us so much, and they had lost something, and it was just, oh, it was, yeah, it was so much more complex, and I think you kind of give it credit.
Yeah, yeah. So your book, Ask Me His Name, let's plug it again.
Why not? Yeah, it comes out paperback on the 7th of March.
There we are. Let's focus on the important things first.
Amazon.co.uk. Yeah.
So I read it a few months ago, and I'll be totally honest with you, I was nervous about reading it, and I didn't know if I could read it. I didn't know if I could get through it. And I thought, well, I'll give it a go, and if I can't get through it, I picked it up and I sat down and I just read it cover to cover. Like, I had to say to Pete, like, I'm sorry, I have to finish this book. You have to take the kids, because this is so compelling. And just thank you for writing it. I think it's an amazing piece of writing. And it was the first part of the book was especially difficult for me, because I can relate to it a bit, and I know, like, I would never, and I know you get told this a lot, I would never say I know what you've been through. I don't at all. I've no idea. I had a premature baby who was born 2 months early, so I did have experience of that, being in intensive care and that thing. And I can relate to that thing of something goes wrong with the baby. Like, when Joe came out, he wasn't breathing. They had to put him on a ventilator and all that, and they wheeled him off. I didn't get to hold him, all of that stuff. But in my sort of morphine, post-cesarean, post-birth adult state, I was like, oh, but we're in a hospital, and he's not dead. Therefore, like on Casualty, he will be all right. Yeah. You know, he'll get better.
And that, I think, is totally natural. And that was my thinking as well. You know, I thought, well, what? That doesn't happen. And it couldn't happen to me. And it only happens to other people. And it's never happened to anybody I know. So can't be a thing. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
exactly,
I
think, exactly.
And then, you know, you find yourself, as you know, in a neonatal intensive care unit. Mm. And it's like this weird...
It's Kafkaesque. It's just...
It was just bizarre. And you're just looking at all these other parents around... fish tanks. They look like fish tanks. With the, you know, Teddy was, I mean, he was a term baby, so he was one of the bigger ones, even though he was only 6 pounds something. He was big. I was looking at some of the little babies, the tiny babies, and yeah, it blows your mind. Like, and you know, I am now on the sort of charity group for the neonatal unit. That's why I focus a lot of my energy into fundraising for them and being part of that. And so I go back to the neonatal unit every month. And it never stopped blowing my mind how incredible it is, and the care that they give to those little people to kind of get them going and get them, like, into this whole game of life. And it's mental.
I think it's amazing that you go back. I went back once when Joe was well and he'd been out of hospital for a long time, and I found it incredibly hard. Was really upset for the rest of the day, and I've not been able to go back since. So I think that's amazing that you've
the first time was really hard. I remember going back for, and I read about it in the book, I went, another plug, I went...
what? You've written the book?
Yeah, I know. It's hard to believe. I don't talk about it much. It's a bit like my kitchen extension. I never mention it.
You should have thought it asked me about my book.
That's the next book. Yeah, it's a follow-up. It's a book about your book.
I am one of these people, though. I do refer back to things. So it's like the time I met Duncan from Blue. I never stopped going on about it.
Oh, he's another plug there. But so, you go back to the unit. You were saying the first time.
Time I went back, and I can remember not really thinking about it. And I'm sure you didn't when you went back. And then we'd gone to like a charity. They were having a relaunch of the charity downstairs, and I went with my husband and my mother-in-law, and it was all fine. And then the lady who's like the charity sort of key person said, oh, do you want to come up and see the piece of equipment that you've bought with your fundraising so far? I was like, yeah. And then I got in the lift and I realised that I hadn't been in that lift since the day that we left hospital and Teddy had died. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I just remember thinking, I'm going to be sick. I'm going to be sick and cry at the same time. Yeah. Like, this is going to be really ugly. And
I'm going to throw up on the thing that I just bought.
Yeah. And my husband was like, are you okay? We don't have to do this. We don't have to go. And I was like, no. And then there was this weird thing just like compelling me to go back in, like sort of shoving me through the door to go back in. And it was almost like I had to see it for myself to sort of break through a pain barrier. And I talk about that a lot when I'm writing, that it's almost like ripping off a plaster. The more that I said after Teddy died, Teddy has died, out loud, it's like my subconscious was like, oh, okay, that's what's happened. And going back to the neonatal unit, I think, was a big part of that for me. I needed to walk in, stand and look to where he had been, where he had existed, so that in my head I could get it. And it was just, I mean, it was so weird. That was like a year later. And there I was, like a psychopath pressed up against the glass. The other parents in there probably thought, what is going on? Like, tears streaming down my face. And then when I did it, I came away and I thought, I've done it now. I've done it. It was really hard and it felt awful at moments. But at the same time, it kind of felt really good. Because he wasn't here anymore, and it was one of the few places that he had been. That sounds really... I promise I'm not mental. It sounds weird, but it felt really like, okay, this makes sense. And so when they then asked me to be on the charity committee, because we were carrying on fundraising, I was like, yeah, totally, I will, and I'll come back. And some days I go back, like last week I went back and I was fine all morning, and then as I was leaving I had a bit of a wobble, and I think I just go, right, I've got to go now, see you later. Yeah. And you just have to take yourself out of that situation, but as long as you manage it healthily, it's okay.
That's it. And another thing that stood out for me in that beginning part of the book was when you talk about how people talk about your baby when you're in intensive care and how they refer to him. And you know, we had a Doctor Who, so in King's, where Joe was, they have little labels. And we didn't have a name for him either, because we, you know, he was 2 months early and we just hadn't really got our shit
got to
together.
That point.
We had a fucking pack of nappies and useless. But they have little blue or pink labels to show if it's a boy or a girl. Let's not have an argument now.
Let's
about
not get
gender,
onto this.
Nobody can be asked to talk
I
about
wanted
that.
An orange label, thank you.
Yes. But that's what
they
do.
No.
I want a glitter label.
Only because I was watching Lorraine Kelly this morning. Just edit this out. I was watching Lorraine Kelly
this morning.
And she was talking about who's had two children. I think it was Kate Hudson or somebody, Hollywood star. She's got two children and she's bringing them up gender neutral. So she was talking about her daughter, who is 4 or 5, and she was saying, oh, she has more of a female energy about her, but we would never refer to her as a girl. It's up to her what she then decides to be. I don't really know. Jury's out on that one. I just think,
I mean, if it floats your boat,
yes.
Not my bad.
Jury says, fuck off.
It's
jury,
our podcast.
Jury's back in. You can fuck yourself off. Go fuck yourself. That's what I say.
Anyway, the blue label.
Yes, we're talking about
we're not talking about your book, we're just talking about me.
I'm just eating chips, so it's all good.
So they had like pink labels for a girl and blue labels for a boy. And there was this one doctor who like would repeatedly refer to Joe as her. like in conversation, and like, oh, today she's done this and she's had this, and she, and I would correct him every single day, and every, he was a night shift doctor, and every single night he would do the same thing. And I try not to be uptight about this thing, but I did have a thing of, I'm relying on you to keep my baby alive, because they had told me very early on it could go either way. That was the phrase they used. So I was like, I'm trusting you to keep my baby alive, and you can't even get his fucking gender right, and he's got a blue fucking sticker on his incubator. That does worry me about your competency as a human generally. And then one night, I was a bit not judging. Yeah,
sort your shit out.
Not looking for someone to put my rage about what's happened to me. not looking for anyone to project that onto at all. And then
here it is.
And I don't know if you have this, but they have all these charts at the end of the beds with all the sets and the breathing and the heartbeat. And I became like a nerd, and I just became obsessed with those every day. And I would check them and obsessively, you know. And I would always want to talk to the doctors and say, what can you, you know, what does this mean and how's that? And one day I remember I asked the nurse to go and get this doctor. It was the same blue-pink doctor. And he came in and he went, ah, the Gibsons. Always asking questions. I was like, my baby's in fucking intensive care. Here's a question. Why are you such a prick? I didn't say that.
I wish you had.
They work very hard. He's obviously in the minority. We love the NHS. We love the nurses and the doctors. They work incredibly hard for no money. But like, because you do write a bit about that in the book, don't you, about how important it is to talk about Teddy.
Yeah, and I think, going back to what you just said about doctors and nurses as well, since I wrote the book, the majority of people who take the time to write a lengthy email to me about the effect it's had on them work in the professional medical profession. That's what they do. And they say, you know, I'm a neonatalist, or I'm a midwife, or I'm a NICU nurses. They love writing to me, and it's wonderful. And I think for them, you know, they have to deliver great news, but also bad news on a week-in, week-out basis. And I think it's very difficult for them to imagine what that journey looks like for a parent, a family, after they leave. Mm. And I think that's why, for me, talking about him is not only hugely therapeutic for us and to kind of keep him in the present and ensure that he doesn't become a thing of the past, but for other people, just to understand that actually, that's cool and we want to talk about him and that's fine. And I think if you talk to any other parents who, I mean, certainly all of the girls who I've made friends with who've lost their baby through neonatal death or stillbirth, or later in infancy, in cot death or as a toddler from illness, they just say the last thing that I want is for people to pretend that they didn't exist. Mm. And I think a couple of girls who I've met have had triplets and one of the babies hasn't survived, or had twins and one of the babies hasn't survived, and now their children are at the age where they're going to nursery, and so they're having to sort of say to the nursery, like, make sure that people know that she's a twin, or make sure that people know that they're triplets but one of them isn't here. And, you know, because they don't want their kids to be called twins when actually, you know, their daughter's missing and not here, and actually that's part of the kid's identity as they grow up. You know, they need to know that they had a brother or sister that isn't here with them. And I think that's so important. Just to normalise the conversation, because in the UK we are fucking weird at talking about difficult stuff. Mm. Is it different down under? What are you guys doing down there?
I think we're worse. I think we're worse because, you know, oh no, don't make a fuss. Leave him alone. Let's go outside.
But I've been that person who knows something terrible has happened, and like, especially if you're in a public situation, like, you don't want to upset the person. Yeah. And you're like, maybe you don't know them that well, maybe you're not actually a good friend or a relative, and you're like, do I mention this and risk upsetting you, maybe in your workplace or whatever, or, you know, and let's face it, if it's easier not, isn't it, sometimes? Yeah. But you think people, you should do it?
In my opinion, obviously, I can't speak for everybody. I'm well aware of that when I'm writing. I'm not, like, the guru on grief. I don't think I've got this all figured out at all.
I mean, that's a great title.
Minister for Baby Loss. That's, well done. Congratulations.
Fucking hell. Yeah. There's a title I never... And I think that's the dangerous game that you play when you share your own experience. Right. Mm. Is that then you, you know, and you take it as far as writing a whole book about it, I think people then come to you and they you know, I get a lot of direct messages on Instagram because I've opened up about my feelings, then from other mothers or from friends or family or colleagues of somebody who that's just happened to, and they're asking me, what is the right thing to do? Mm. What is the right thing to say? And I don't know, because I've never met that person. Yeah. I don't know a thing about them, and I don't know where they are at in that stupid graph about grief that doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that day they're going to be really upset, or if that day they're going to be fine and want to talk about it, or if they're going to be, you know, we all have different days, and that's with grief or without. Some days we wake up in a great mood and we want to have a laugh, and some days we're like, why is this my life and the world is against me? And I think that's really difficult to know. But what I normally say to people is, like, if it's in the early stages and you haven't spoken to them yet, like, you've not had any dialogue, and you find out through a friend that your friend has just lost a child, then just send something, even if it's a heart emoji. If you haven't got the words, you don't try and find them if you think you can fuck it up and offend somebody. Just send. I think that, for me, was the important thing, was just to know that people were there. If and when I was ready to see them and wanted to talk about it, just to know that they were there. And I always say this, is like, silence is really deafening when somebody just ignores you and pretend it doesn't happen. It didn't happen.
Because you know that they know. And it's weird.
And then that's weird. Yeah. And then, you know, and I have had, there are still a couple of people who, since Teddy died, which will be 3 years ago in May, I would have had sort of fairly regular dialogue with them, even if it was just on social media or through text message, you know, people I'd used to work with or whatever. Not a peep, not a Scooby. And now, it's gone too far now, hasn't it? You know, it gets to a point where if you ignore something for that long and then nobody says anything, it's like, and I do think also, to a certain degree, it's a generational thing as well. A lot of older people, and I'm talking much older people, so like my granddad is nearly 90 and he has never said to me anything about Teddy. It's like one time he saw me at my brother's wedding and I was 9 months pregnant, and the next time he saw me a couple of months after Teddy died and he acted like nothing had happened. And it was because, for him, and it's not because he doesn't care, I know that. I know it's not because he doesn't care, it's because he is of that generation where he doesn't know how to handle it and what to say, or whether he's going to upset me. So in his head, being a nearly 90-year-old man from the north of England, who I think goes for that very sort of stoic, stiff upper lip thing, he's just gone, don't say anything.
Yeah.
And that's what he's told himself. And I know, I don't take any offence, because I know that he's my granddad and he loves me, and that's not changed.
Yeah.
He just can't do it. He can't even. You know, we get these people who just go to say something, they just, they can't be emotional, can't say anything.
It's that thing of, you know, I'm speaking to myself, nothing, I know that nothing I can say to you can make it better.
Yeah.
Nothing can ease your pain, nothing, so I think maybe for some people it's like, oh, well, if I say something, I might increase the pain momentarily, so maybe it's better just to do nothing, but you think.
And that's what I also say to people. So not that long ago, I think it was during Baby Loss Awareness Week, and I was, you guys probably saw what I was doing that week, because I was doing events and radio stuff and media stuff and interviews, and it got really intense. Like, it was really,
you give a lot of yourself.
It was really intense. Yeah. And my mum said to me, God, you know what? I honestly don't know how you do that some days. Like, I don't know how you drag yourself through it. The reason that I carry on doing it, carry on talking about it, is because every day it's happening to other people. So every day in the UK, 15 babies die. And that's not including miscarriage. That's a statistic from 2017. It's a stillbirth and neonatal death. So I think it was like 9 stillborn and 6 neonatal death in the first few weeks of life. Every day in the UK. So that's thousands of parents and families every year.
Yeah.
So that tells me that there are 15 women every day going, what the fuck am I going to do now? This is terrifying. I'm staring into the abyss. And that somebody needs to be talking about it, because when it happened to me, I couldn't find anyone who was talking about it in a really open forum and being like, look at me, guys, I'm still semi-normal and it hasn't ended my life, and there are still so many other things in my life that I enjoy and I've carried on enjoying. And so that's why I do it, really. I think it is, again, like ripping off a plaster. Nothing like you said, nothing that I say or anyone else can say, or nothing.
No matter how much I tilt my head, you talk about the head tilt.
Yeah, nothing.
How much I tilt my head, it's not
going to
help.
Anybody says to me or asks me, or anything that I answer back in a question, can make it hurt more. Like, because the bad bit's already happened. Right. Like, the worst bit happened the day that Teddy died. Like, that was the worst moment in my life, and I remember my husband saying after we'd got through the funeral, and I write about that in the book, is we were walking away from the funeral and he squeezed my hand and he said, nothing can feel as bad as this. We've come through the two, these have to be the two worst days now. They have to be.
Yeah.
And actually it was one of the very few very sensible things that my husband's ever said in our entire relationship. And he was right, because actually I really clung on to that and I held on to it and thought, yeah, nothing can hurt that much now.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, because you have a, I think you have a whole chapter, don't you, called The Benchmark of Shit.
Which I thought you'd like that one.
I love that. Where you have people say, oh, this, you know, my hair's falling, I don't know, my hair's falling out, is that a thing? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
you know, I've had a car crash or whatever.
Yeah.
Or my dog died or,
But then they go, oh, but of course it's nothing compared to what we've been through. And you realise one day that you and Nico and, you know, what happened to Teddy, you were now the benchmark.
We were it. We were as bad as it could get in life. And I just remember, and it was, I think it was a particularly bad week of head tilts and I'm so sorry's and, you know, people trying, scrabbling to say the right thing. And I totally got it was coming from a really good place. But I realised in conversations with a lot of my friends that week, they were telling me something that had been going on in their life or a friend's life. And then they quickly caveat it with, of course, it's nothing compared to what's happened to you. It's nothing compared to what you're going through. And I was like,
you're like, I know that!
Fucking great. So you're saying I'm literally the worst. And I think it was one of those things where if you didn't laugh about it, you would just think, well, what is the point? And I wrote that. My editor said it was her favourite title to the chapter. I think it's what she's ever heard.
I think it's what you should have called the book. The Benchmark of Shit by Elle Wright. The story of loss and learning to laugh again.
But it is. And I think it's, you just kind of have to accept it and be like, well, I'm not going to think 2 months ahead, 6 months ahead, a year ahead. I'm just going to sit in the here and now and wake up each day. And maybe that will be a day where it's harder to swing your legs around the bed and get out. Or maybe it'll be easier that day and you'll feel great when you get up. But just like take each day as it comes and not try and like get ahead of myself.
Well, we're very lucky and grateful that today you were able to get out of bed, to come to Southeast London to just talk about to some twats. Possibly aren't taking this seriously enough. Who knows? But how are things now? As you say, so it'll be 3 years in May since Teddy died.
Yeah,
things are. I mean, I didn't go back to my job. That's probably like the biggest life change that I've had. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here on a sofa with you guys now.
I mean, I think you've made the right choice.
That was, I guess, for me, the biggest sort of personal change. And that wasn't really a conscious decision. That was more of a, I can't go back to giving a shit about skincare. I worked for L'Oreal and it was a really good job. And I'd worked my entire career in the spa industry. I was on the road in sales and I was in London and I was in meetings all day. And I thought, I'm going to have to walk. I know that the first 3 months back at work is going to be going into my 80 something accounts that I had to have my first meeting with them, and every single one is going to be telling the whole story again and again. Yeah. And I just thought, that is going to be so bad for my
mental. Sounds shit.
I was just like, so I just called my boss after a bit of thinking on it. And luckily, in the UK, we're really lucky. If you leave on maternity leave to have your baby and you've gone off on your maternity leave, regardless of the outcome, if your baby lives or your baby is not here, you still are entitled to your full maternity leave. So I had some time to think about what the hell I was going to do next and whether I was going to go back to work or not. And I decided that that job and that wouldn't be for me anymore. I would have loved to have been able to go back to my normal life and, you know, feel normal again, but I just couldn't feel it. And I kind of had this weird feeling of guilt as well, because it was like everything I'd ever worked towards, and then I was just going to sack it all off and go, oh, no, it's not really for me anymore. I don't really want to do that. So that was quite weird. But in that time, in the last sort of couple of months before I was due to go back to work, I'd started the blog. And then sort of literally a few months after I'd said I wasn't going back to work in the March, and by the June, that was when a literary agent contacted me and said, do you want to write a book?
And you said, yes, it's going to be called The Benchmark of Shit. And then here we are today.
I do. Yeah. Now people go, oh, what next? What next? Oh, I don't have a clue. I don't really know what's next. Mm. We would love to have more children. We still raise a lot of money in Teddy's name. So that's a big part, as I said, of what I do. Volunteer for the charity. And the book is raising money for Tommy's The Baby Charity. And yeah, my husband's done various challenges last year. Him and his friends cycled across France for 1600 or 1700 kilometres in a week, and they raised £30,000 and bought a new incubator for the. So we kind of just keep it going in what we're doing, but in ourselves, I guess we're the same as we always were, but obviously things are different now. If that,
yeah.
But then I think that's after you've had kids anyway.
You're
still you, kind of under the surface, but it's just a bit different now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So tell us about Feathering the Empty Nest then.
I think I wanted a creative outlet, somewhere to sort of talk about Teddy, but also talk about all the other stuff in my life that I loved. So staring down the barrel of a year off work and not having a baby there, the worst things just happen. So you're kind of navigating each day to day, thinking, right, what can I do to fill my day to day? What can I do that's going to take my mind off of this shitstorm? So for me, I mean, the whole house, if it wasn't like on fire, I was painting it and or just doing something, because I needed to be busy. I needed to. So every single room in our house just got done and done again and this and that. You know, I was constant, and it was really, really therapeutic because it gave me somewhere to focus, creativity. And then when I started thinking about writing about Teddy and trying to kind of create a space that wasn't just all about how miserable that was as an event, but actually my life as a whole and all of the other things that I enjoyed. And the way that I kind of rationalise it to other people is, if Teddy were here and I had decided to write something or do something, a blog, I would have included him in all the other stuff that I loved. So just because he's not here, why would I go, oh, okay, I'm going to start one blog about the fact my baby died, and then I'm going to start another blog about all the happy stuff in my life. Smash them together and see what happens was what the way that I thought. It
made it, I don't know why I'm getting upset now. We're talking about fucking paint.
So moved.
We've done Teddy dying in intensive care, and now you're talking about your fucking blog, and I've lost my shit. I don't know what's come over me.
Ellie's gone. I know.
We're supposed to be moving on.
Jesus.
Sorry,
Elle. Safer again.
I know. I'm just going to rub here.
And now, Elle, I'd like you to comfort me. That's always good, isn't it? Let's make this about me again. I'm very upset. Can you make me feel better, please?
Oh my God.
About what happened to you.
sorry.
No, not at all. But the reason was, I think I wanted to do something that I saw was positive, which is how I viewed my blog, because when Teddy died and I was feeling a bit desperate and trying to search for other women or other parents who had gone through what I'd gone through, I couldn't find anyone who was talking about it but also talking about their normal life. Like, it was like that was all they were talking about. So I mean, I understand it's a huge thing to happen and it's really sad and it does kind of take over your life to a certain extent for a long period of time, but it just made me more miserable. And it just made me think, I don't want to read about how fucking miserable this is, because I'm already in that and I am living that every single day of my life. I want somebody to tell me, one day you're going to wake up and you're going to have a great day again, and you're going to laugh and you're going to get pissed with your friends, or this is going to be fun, or you're going to listen to music and not burst out into tears, and it's going to be normal, you're going to feel normal, whatever that is.
Have you had that day yet?
Yeah, I've had loads of those days, and when I do have it, I go onto Instagram stories and I tell people, because I am really aware that there are other parents following me who are in those first few weeks, few months, or however long, and just feeling desperate, and I want to be the one to say, guys, like, this was really good today and it made me laugh. And actually, I think we should all sort of do that, really, shouldn't we? When we're having a great time, revel in that, we should celebrate it, and we shouldn't, it was very British again, we don't want it because we look like smug bastards, don't we?
Yeah, I know. Can I just say at this point, I'm currently vegan.
Oh, and fucking hell! Oh, my God!
And I really like it.
Listen, at least when I make it about me, it's about baby shit. Veganism has nothing to do with babies, being in the hospital.
How's it going?
I love it.
She's high.
I feel high.
Oscar, she's going to keep doing it in February.
I'm trying to. It makes me feel very happy.
Does it?
I feel so good. So good.
See, I'm a veggie, but I don't tell anyone.
Exactly.
That's because you're a good person.
I decided to share something. You were opening up, and I had to open up.
Veganism's the one for you.
Yeah.
We'll have this conversation again in 6 months and see.
Ellie should
try
for 3 weeks. She'll be chowing down, throwing hand down.
Throwing up in the air.
Gotcha. First of February, she'll be shoving pepperonis in every orifice.
Oh my God, I'll just be like, I'll be filleting some hot dogs.
I think when we're happy, we should be like, this is really good and I feel great. And so I have purposefully gone onto Instagram, you know, when we've been down in Cornwall or whatever, and I've had a first normal day where I felt pretty good, and I've said, look guys, I feel great today, and I'm just telling you, in case you're in a place where you think that's never going to happen for you again, I promise you it will. Like, I promise you, because I thought it was never going to happen.
And I think this is going to, I can't say it in the right words,
no, there aren't,
but you paint a rainbow of grief, right? And it's not one colour. And it's not one thing. And that's what I love about your blog, is that you like, it's a shit day. And then it's a great day.
Yeah.
And then we haven't even fucking talked about Boris the Pug.
Oh.
Here we go. But like, but that's what I love. And it you know, I haven't experienced it but I love your story and I love your journey and I love reading the comments as well.
You love pugs.
And I love pugs. Really love
pugs. How is Project Pug going?
Well, we have to. I mean, I feel like a connection here. We can't get a dog until we've renovated the house. So we want to. I'm making my own pug nest. That's what I'm saying. And then I can get my pug. And we talk about it a lot at our house.
We talk about it.
I want to call her Princess Diana.
She is a royalist.
It's what she would have wanted. It was her dream. William and Harry would be very honoured.
Princess Diana.
Well, it feels a bit incongruous because it's been quite intense, mainly for me.
It's
been a journey, guys. It's been a journey. Now, we do always finish the podcast with Scummy Mummy Confessions. So this is a story of parenting failure or personal humiliation.
I've got a good one of Boris.
Go.
The other day, I was walking Boris in the woods, as I do, and pugs are inherently greedy little fuckers. So they will eat everything if it's not nailed down or on fire. Like, you need to watch out. Anyway, he saw these kids in the forest and they'd made these, like, it was like school holidays, they'd made these jumps. Kids make bike tracks and stuff, don't they, boys, when they get to a certain age. Or girls. Orange sticker. And they Anyway, they had this. He had this. They all had their bags. We live in Surrey, so it was a Waitrose bag on the floor, and they had kept their biscuits and their snacks and everything. And I saw Boris running towards. I was like, no. So anyway, managed to get him away. Carried on our walk for like another however long, and then when we were walking back, we were on the other side of the woods, quite a distance away, and I noticed I'd lost Boris. I'd lost it. He had tracked back across the forest like a pig, sniffing out a truffle, and I actually had to, like, it was like a slow-mo run as I went running for him, and all I could see was this pug's ass in the air. He had immersed himself in a Waitrose bag, finished a packet of ginger biscuits. He had the whole packet in his mouth just as these kids were running over towards him, and I was like, I'm so sorry. I was mortified, so embarrassed. Like, my pug's just covered in ginger nut. Like a ginger nut facial.
At least it was a Waitrose bag.
Anyway, I know. And as I pick him up, oh, the shame, like apologising to these kids, he just goes, and like does this massive pug belch, like echoes around the forest.
Awesome.
It was so, and they were luckily, I mean, that was probably the only sustenance they had for the day.
Yeah.
The pug had eaten the lot. And because he did this big belch, it made it really funny. They were fine about it. They were chilled.
Oh, and, the burp saved the day.
It did. So that's my bad pug parenting story.
Well done, Boris. Amazing scenes.
Oh, no, I've got one, actually. So I recently bought the kids for Christmas matching onesies, and I had little stars on them, and they're really cute. And they've got little buttons that go up. But my son is thrilled because he doesn't have to take it off to go to the toilet. He just yanks out his willy and wees directly from his PJs. And he thinks, I mean, we're all thrilled for him.
Yeah.
And he was so happy about that, he told our neighbour when she came over. He said, I can just go to the toilet. And she said, and I just pull out my willy like this. And he pulled out his willy and showed my neighbour Jo. She's like, that's great, Hugo. I'm like, could not be prouder. So
that was a key parenting moment.
Yeah. Oh. I was like, it's good to share.
Well,
yeah.
Let's hope he grows out of that.
Yes.
Oh, well, so your book, let's do it one more time. Ask Me His Name. It's out now.
Ask Me His Name is out now in hardback form, Ellie. Yeah. But on the 7th of March, it will be coming out in paperback.
Well, there we go.
Excellent.
So there's a date to look forward to.
There is. Excellent stuff. So people can follow you at Feathering the Empty Nest.
That is me, yeah.
And they can follow us at Scummy Mummies.
That's right, scummymummies.com for gigs, podcast, the whole shebang.
Yes, and our book is
still in print. So that's great, and it's available, you know, where you buy books.
Well, thank you so much, Elle. We've laughed, we've cried. I think I've been more emotional than anyone, quite honestly.
This is amazing.
Yes, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Tell us about tea.
All right. Thank you.
Until next time.
Bye-bye!
I just think it's a really important book and really compelling, and, you know,
I read 2/3 of your book and it was awesome.
What happened to the other half?
I usually do is I read the first half,
okay,
and then I get tired, and then nothing to do with your writing, and then I read the last chapter so I know what happens in the end.
Oh.
So all those words I read were great.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah. Again, going back to maybe sometimes it's a good idea to hold things.
I like the honesty. I'm pretty sure some of my mates haven't read it all the way through. I wouldn't worry. They probably just told, oh yeah, that bit you said, that was really good.
I love that bit.
It was so impactful. I read it in one sitting. I didn't finish it. You know, that's... There you are.
I didn't finish it. I've read the last chapter.
That's not finishing it. It's reading most of it. Oh, dear.
It's so good.
Cut that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh.
Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.